history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really ought to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained. Often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And what a story we have in store for you today. You're going to hear about a device you've probably used thousands of times in your life that you don't know the origin of, and you're going to learn that today. You're going to hear from a man who really improved on it and spread it around the country. You're also going to learn about the Battle of Midway and how the intelligence came to being, how America found out what was happening on the Japanese side of things. And there are many, many other details. If you're a fly fisherman, maybe you'd like to hear some of the latest exploits of 104-year-old Jack Perrin, who joins us from Santa Barbara, California. That was not a misstatement. He really is 104 years old. So, Jack, I think we've got to start there, because I'm sure most people have never talked to someone who's 104. I usually save this for the end, but I'm going to go right up front. What's your secret? How have you made it to 104 years old and still be as sharp as you are today?
Well, I have a joke. I always tell everybody it's tequila. But it's not really.
I mean, there must be something that you have done or practiced or maintained to still be going so strong at that incredible age.
Well, I don't know. My mother was up in her middle 90s, and my real father was up there pretty much in the 90s, but he was divorced. I had was raised by a stepfather, but the real father was a Dane. He and my mother divorced.
And I was reading about that in your book, On a Roll, the story of entrepreneur Jack Perrin and Towel Saver Incorporated. Some people might recognize that Towel Saver name. Even if they don't, they've used a towel saver before. And I understand that this idea of a paper towel dispenser was actually born at a USC-UCLA football game when you went with Jay Perrin, your adoptive father?
That's absolutely correct. I was with him.
So what happened? Tell us the story.
Well, that was the old days when the big Coliseum was a small. It wasn't as big as it is now. My dad would go to the games a lot. He'd take me. And he was in the restroom one time. I was with him. And you notice on the little square boxes where they have a folded towel, one fold, you pull one towel down that is divided in half. Sometimes now you pull one out, it comes like an accordion, but a lot of them are come by with this one fold. Well, they used to put a package on top of the dispenser, and like play special like the Coliseum. And, of course, they get spilled on the floor and it would be a big mess. But nevertheless, that was a problem.
So he noticed that, and he thought, hey, maybe there's a better way to do this?
He thought there was a better way to do it. He picked them up, and he theoretically met. His dad was an inventor, too, actually. This is my stepdad now.
Right.
Wonderful guy. Wonderful man. A great father. Well, somebody, of course, naturally pulls it down. The whole thing goes on the floor. And so he saw that, and he got thinking about it. And so that's when he invented the thing that he invented, a paper towel dispenser. He had a lot of patents on it, and it was very good.
And so this was the first ever paper towel dispenser. So you're a boy growing up around his whole process of demoing this, finding money to support the invention, actually producing it and distributing it. So you saw a lot of that process play out. I bet that was fascinating for you to witness as a boy.
Well, he had been in the oil business where he sold rope for hemp oil companies to the purchasing agents. But he knew them all. That's how he got his start, because he'd go around all the purchasing agents that he knew, and he used to give a big party for them once a year. So he had a very good cadre of friends. He was very well thought of. and a very nice guy, Jay Perrin.
And I want to come back around to your own role in growing TowelSaver and the things that you did with it after World War II. But before we get into the war, I'm just curious for you as a young boy, growing up in Southern California, was there something you had in your mind, some kind of hope or dream or ambition that someday this is what Jack Perrin's going to do?
I really never thought of that. I was very busy doing what I had to do. I worked on Saturday mornings when I was going to high school. I'd go down there working. We'd have these dispensers that we loaned out for no charge. And if they would buy our paper, I worked two jobs, really, because we didn't have much money in those days. We'd fix these dispensers. They'd have a crank on them, little square boxes. It was when they first came out. And you lift the lever and you turn a crank and you get one towel. And the whole theory was that you'd have to do a little work to get a paper towel, and you wouldn't do in this old-fashioned way where you put a whole package on top and one falls on the floor. And that's what happened down at the Coliseum. And that was one thing that encouraged my father to develop the TowelSaver.
And you mentioned something there that I was struck by when reading your book here, On a Roll, where you said when he first developed this TowelSaver, he did one thing that was really crucial ultimately to the success of it. He didn't charge people for the dispensers. He let them use them for free.
Right.
But the paper had to be your paper because the dispenser wouldn't work with any other paper.
Absolutely.
Genius.
That carried on for a long time till the government didn't like it. They said it was not fair or something like that. I don't know.
What high school did you go to?
I went to Fairfax High School.
And you were a pretty good athlete, I understand?
I wasn't real good, no, but I was satisfactory. I threw the shot put and discus, and the only one that beat me was Woodrow Strode, who was a very good athlete, but he developed some kind of a problem health-wise, and he couldn't do it anymore. So I took over as number two man on the UCLA team.
Yeah, so you're at UCLA. In the late 30s, you finally graduated in 1941. When I saw that, immediately, I thought of some of the other people who were there at that time. Woody Strode is one of them. He went on to quite a career in acting. People have seen him in Spartacus. I believe he also did some wrestling for a while and was a great football player on the UCLA team. And you played football there, too?
Oh, he was a good football player. Strode and Kenny Washington, and very nice people, nice men. And very well thought of. Kenny was a pretty good friend of mine. He's a very nice guy, Kenny was. And Strode, and they would pal around together, and they were always in classes with some of them. I put the shot in discus.
Wasn't that the same time that guy Jackie Robinson was there?
That's exactly right. He'd come by and say, "Move away, I'm Jackie Robinson."
What did you enjoy the most about your time at UCLA? What was the highlight for you?
Well, I was in the fraternity. I still have my ring where I was president of my fraternity. We had two men that were children of, what's the guy's name, the movie actor with a big loud mouth.
Joey Brown?
Yeah, Joey Brown Sr. and his two sons were in our fraternity. And his dad, Big Mouth Joe, you know, he came and registered in one class for 1 year, one semester, so he could become a fraternity member too.
The father did?
Yeah.
Huh.
He was a nice very nice guy. I enjoy them all very much.
You know, one thing that I like to ask all the veterans I interview about, because it seems like everybody remembers something, whenever I throw out that date, December 7th, 1941, there always seems to be a memory. What do you remember about that day and how you found out about what happened at Pearl Harbor?
Yes, I do remember very well. When I was working for Aetna Life Insurance Company in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I graduated from UCLA. I got a job. My girlfriend picked up my diploma for me because I had to stay and work out of Pennsylvania. We arranged to get married, and then we decided not to. So we later on, when the war started and everything went differently, we stuck away and got married.
I'm always fascinated by the reasoning behind decisions like that because I've had a lot of veterans who say, well, I didn't want to get married in case I didn't come back. And I've had a lot of other veterans say, I wanted to get married even if I didn't come back. Was that something that crossed your mind that as you joined the Navy, regardless of the kind of work that you were going to be doing, that there was a chance you wouldn't come back to your wife?
It never entered my mind. We flew to Las Vegas to get married. And it was very funny because I didn't know how to salute or anything. And I got my commission in the Navy. I went down and bought my uniform and everything I was supposed to do. And in those days, if you went to college, you could become an officer right away, which was my case. I didn't have to go to officer's school or any of that stuff.
So you hadn't actually reported yet, but you had your uniform, and you got married in your uniform?
Yes, I did. I got off the plane. There was a guard there with a rifle and bayonet and everything, and he was saluting me. Hell, I didn't know how to salute, but I just said hi and didn't salute, which I feel embarrassed about ever since. But anyway, that's what was life in those days. We came back home and had 10 delightful days of a honeymoon, and I had saved up for a few $1,000s, and I said, saved it all. We spent all San Francisco, going to all the places and restaurants and places my father had gone to when he was in business, and they knew him, but a lot of them, so I had a pretty good deal. And a good friend of his let us use his apartment and car. He put me in a hotel, both of us, my wife and I. I would get up every morning, pack my suitcase, and go down to the Navy Department. They say to bring your clothes, you may not come back. So every morning for about 10 days, I'd take my suitcase, go down the Naval Building. It's a really big structure in San Francisco, and I'm waiting for a ship to take me away to Hawaii. Took my suitcase every day, every time I do it for about the 10 days, and then one time I didn't come back, and so she knew that. So now I'm gone for 2.5 years. Kind of lonesome.
Well, you know, I wanted to hit on something before I talk about what you did in the Navy, because we're just getting into the Navy part of your story here. You know, 10 days in a row, as you said, you're going down to the Navy office with a suitcase, you're kissing your wife goodbye. The last time you don't come back to her, you don't see her for 2.5 years.
That's right.
But I want to hear what she was doing for those 2.5 years, because she was one of the women all over our country who found a way to contribute to this greater war effort. What was she doing?
She went to work for the big aircraft company, Douglas. She worked for Douglas and saved money, and I saved money, and I sent her as much as I could. But she's living with her mother.
So they send you to Hawaii. I read that you were on basically a banana boat that the Navy put into service.
A banana boat, the USL Salamanca. And on the ship, they had me reading the code. Maybe we'd get messages from other people, and I would help to decipher them and put them in English. Because of that, I think they put me in the Naval Intelligence. They shipped me to Hawaii, and we started off, three actually, ended up doing it, going around checking on people and bad guys and good guys in Hawaii. At this point, we went to work at the Halekulani Hotel, which was owned by a big Navy officer. But that didn't last very long. We had 10 days of heaven, going to the floor shows and everything else in Hawaii. But after about a week, they called us in and said, well, you three guys are going down someplace else. Pack your bag and get in the station wagon. And we did, and went down to the submarine base. And we were both, all three, went in to be inspected. And it was in a secret passageway, kind of, in the basement. We went back down there, and it was a kind of a dungeon place with a special guard and all that. And it turned out to be a very secret place. Is where they were reading the Japanese code. So it was obviously a very secretive place. And we sneak down there. We go down the basic tunnel, another drop down, and you go in the basement of another building that was there. There was a senior officer in charge. He had and a couple other officers around, but there wasn't too many people. And there were about a half a dozen men breaking codes.
Let me bring you right back there in a minute, but I do have another question, because you're arriving there in Hawaii about 6 months after the Japanese arrived in that surprise attack.
We were there in April.
So I'm guessing that you could still see evidence of what had happened in December. What were some of the things you saw, and was it jarring to you? Could you see the Oklahoma, the Arizona?
Oh, yeah, you could see all that. I didn't go out in a boat to look at them, but I could see something sticking up, and I knew, I was aware, of course, that they've been sunk with a lot of men. And then I had another one, but most of the men got off, and they were the band of one of the battleships, and the band got off.
I'm just curious, because here you are, if I do the math, you're 25 years old. This war has started, and now you're at the place where it began, and you're seeing something that I imagine might be a little sobering when you see a battleship upside down or sunk and you know how many lives were lost. Can you help us understand what kind of emotions maybe that produced in you?
I can't recognize that I had emotions. I think maybe I've been getting used to things that didn't bother me.
And you mentioned the band. So you're talking about the USS Maryland, which is another battleship that was damaged at Pearl Harbor. And some of the bandsmen actually ended up working in that code room with you?
Absolutely. They worked with the translators. There were about five translators, about three of them working all the time, reading the Japanese code. There's a certain technique in reading codes and breaking them down, and they were very good at it. And they absorbed both of the music guys that had been on the battleship Maryland, and so most of the band went with our unit, but it was divorced from our unit, but it was part of our unit, you know what I mean?
And this was Hypo?
Yeah. Well, Roford was the commanding officer of the unit, and he was a Mustang, which means he did not go to the academy. The regular Navy people in Washington criticized him, but they wanted to have the glory of some of the success we had.
Well, and I want to talk about some of that success you had, but first maybe you can just help us understand. So this is in the basement of the administration building at Pearl Harbor.
In the basement.
And this is secret work that you guys are doing. So how far did you carry that secrecy? Were you allowed to tell any of your friends that this is what you were doing, or tell your wife that this is you were doing?
Oh, God, no.
No.
Very, very secretive.
Uh-huh.
This is breaking the Japanese code. We broke their code, and they didn't know we had done it. We could read the Japanese stuff, and they couldn't read ours, theoretically. I think they probably did read some of ours, anyway.
I'm curious about the secrecy element. I'm sure you and your wife are writing letters back and forth. What did she think you were doing out there?
Well, every letter she got had things cut out. She didn't know anything about doing.
The censors took some scissors to it?
All my mail was censored, and it was cut out or erased or something.
You know, so many of the vets that I've interviewed were in a plane, you know, flying against the enemy, on a ship in battle with the enemy, in a foxhole watching artillery come in. Here you are in a basement at Pearl Harbor. Did you have a sense of the gravity or importance of your work, and that maybe even lives depended on whether or not you did your work well?
Oh, we understood about the work pretty well, because, I mean, it was so secret and it was so important, because we were reading the code. Let's say it says a 15-20 ship convoy of Japanese coming from down south somewhere, and they're coming up to hugging the coast for safety, and they're coming right back up to Tokyo. We'd get some of those kind of things. So we could set our submarines out. Maybe that'd be my watch. Let's say it's midnight, and I'm the only one on watch. If a message comes through, I'd have to send the message out to our submarine.
So when you say a message comes in, is that a message coming in plain English, or is that encoded?
Well, it could be encoded. Let's say a message comes in Kana alphabet. And the Kana alphabet is, of course, the Japanese alphabet. Mm-hmm. But then we've broken the code so we can read it. Some of them. We have four or five translators that are working on that. And these translators are people, including our commanding officer in my unit. They lived in Japan to learn the customs and to do it. I was very impressed by that. The fact that they had arranged ahead of time to watch out for it.
There are people that have been living in Japan before the war who then could put that knowledge to
use. The Navy places men in key positions where they can learn things that will help them at the time of war. That's what came through to me, and it was very good. These were men like Mike Skipper, Roquefort. He was able to communicate in Japanese because he studied Japanese over there. So anyway, Roquefort was very, very capable man.
And we'll hear more about Joseph Roquefort and the secret work that he and Jack Parent and others carried out at Station Hypo when we come back. The Battle of Midway was the pivotal moment of the Pacific War, but perhaps the most important break in that battle came in that basement dungeon, as Jack called it, at Pearl Harbor. We'll learn more about it from this 104-year-old Navy veteran when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.